Do we have a fine for people who come in late? Or is there stay after class or anything? Good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning. Someone asked the names of my four Mormon elder friends on the current list. There's Elders Hadley, Morris Phipps, and Pendleton. And I asked them this week if I could call them special agent instead of elder, because I thought that would sort of be a variation and give a little variety. And they said, well, yeah, that'd be quite all right with us, but that wouldn't fit on our name tag very well if it said special agent. This week, we went through Belshazzar's feast in Daniel and the fall of Babylon and had a discussion on that, and that was good. And then my friend Wayne, who's 19, asked if he could take them through Romans chapter 2 using the King James Bible, because they use the King James Bible. It's really hard to understand, but we had a nice discussion on Romans 2 and our accountability to God, and they agreed with that. And one of them said it was kind of scary to look forward to the day that Jesus evaluates our lives and looks us in the eye and examines us thoroughly. Anyhow, I think some of these kids really do know Jesus, and hope and pray they would come out of the Mormon church in time. But my time with the Mormons is always fun. We are about chapter 23 in Job. Job, you can see already that this is a very patriarchal culture that Job lives in. We haven't had any women involved in speaking here, with the exception of a very, very brief comment by Job's wife right early on. And then we've got these three crusty, argumentative male friends that come in and give Job a really hard time. For extra credit in this class, I'd like to suggest that some of our fine women here consider let's take a different scenario. Let's suppose that Job had been visited not by three male friends from out of town, but by his wife and his mother and his sister. And the dialogues are with his wife and mother and sister instead of the three friends. How would the story differ? How would the women's point of view differ from what these men have said? And we should assume that the women would be godly and grounded and be able to talk to Job. And of course, in our culture, we value a woman's input and point of view and contribution equally along. But in this patriarchal culture, the women are kind of in the background. So, and as I mentioned earlier in the study, I can't wait to get to heaven and talk to Mrs. Job for her side of things, because there would be a whole other story from the whole thing, the way she perceived it. Probably. Oh, dear. We're broadcasting into outer space here. So that's your. If you want to write that up, if you would like to write up the woman's point of view and a woman's advice to Job, I would be happy to read it or pass it out or something like that. So that would be extra credit for this class. Now, Job's three friends, shocked and horrified at the pitiful state that Job is in, with terrible, ugly, painful boils all over his body, and his property all gone, and his 10 children dead, and his estate in ruins. They're absolutely horrified, and early on convinced themselves that the only possible explanation for Job's tragedy is that he has somehow sinned. That is very logical, that he is suffering the consequences of sin. And they, all three of them, come to that conclusion. And they don't ever budge on that point of view from the beginning. And every time they make a speech, that's their presupposition, that God is just and God judges sin. And you were rich and famous and well-known before, but now you're in ruins. And certainly that's the hand of God because of sin in your life. And if you just repent, God would give you your life back. It turns out not to be the right answer at all. It turns out to be that that's not what God is doing. God is not punishing Job for his sins, and God is not chastening Job. So these guys are wrong, and they're self-righteous, and they're getting to be nastier and more pharisaical, and it hurts like crazy. These three men are the tools of God because God has something he wants to accomplish in Job's life. So they're even though they're acting in the flesh and not being very compassionate or empathetic or loving, nevertheless, as we'll see later on, they're serving God's purposes. We've just had a speech in chapter 22. Oh, I have to tell you a little bit about how I operate here. We push the start button and I'll start talking. And if you push pause, I'll answer your questions. And if you push fast forward, I'll jump ahead a whole chapter and lose my place in the text and we'd be in the Psalms or something like that. And then if I forget the end of the class, somebody should push stop because I'm kind of autopilot here. I read Job 4 or 5 times and look at some commentaries and mark up my margins, and then Sunday morning I have to remember where we left off, which I think was in chapter 23. In chapter 23, Job has his third reply to his friend Eliphaz, and he says, "Even today my complaint is bitter, my hand is listless because of my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, God, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I know the words which he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Would he contend with me in his great power? No, but he would take note of me. Then the upright would reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge." I'd like to get an appearance in court with God and argue my case before him. And if I could do that, God doesn't seem to hold the court on a fixed schedule. I don't know where I'd find the right kind of attorney to represent my case against God. But he does believe in his heart of hearts that if he could get a hearing with God, that God would answer him favorably and vindicate him. Because Job believes that he's righteous. He doesn't see any known sin in his life, and he has this trust that God will, in the end, somehow vindicate him. One of the major problems Job has is not having a mediator or a vindicator, not feeling that that a mere human being can go to this Almighty God and find a sympathetic hearing. And then how do you subpoena God and ask God to show up in court? And God's not just another attorney in court; he's the judge. So that's what Job's talking about here. He says in verse 8, "Look, I go forward and he's not there, and backward I can't perceive him. When he works on the left hand, I can't behold him. When he turns to the right hand, I cannot see him." That's how unsearchable are God's judgments and his ways past finding out. You know, you try to figure out how God's done something or where he is, or you try to talk him into answering your prayer and he doesn't. And when he does answer your prayer, he answers you in a surprising way. So you can't pin him down. God will not be pinned down in his sovereignty. And one of the problems Job has here is that God's been silent through this whole time. And Job's been crying out to God, and God doesn't say anything. And, of course, Job's friends are convinced that the fact that God is silent is only more proof that he's sinning. And God won't answer him until he goes through his repenting. Then God will restore him. That's not right. Verse 10, "He knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold." I really, really believe that God's going to vindicate me in the end. I really trust in God that he's just, but he's also good. So that's positive note here. So in the midst of the most miserable situation that he could possibly imagine, he hasn't lost his basic faith, and he hasn't blasphemed God, and he hasn't accused God of doing evil against him. So that's good. "My foot has held fast to his steps. I've kept his way and not turned aside. I've not departed from the commandment of his lips. I've treasured the words of his mouth more than my necessary food." In my whole life long, I've always done what is right. I've always I've been honest, and I haven't lied, and I haven't cheated, and I've treated my employees right, and I've tried to be a good citizen in the community. So everything that I know how to do that would line up to what God is like, that's what I've done. Now, is that enough? Is that what God wants us to do? Is that what makes you a righteous person? That you line up your life with what you know is pleasing to God, and you live that way. Is that enough? No, it really isn't quite enough. Not quite enough. If you live that kind of a life where you, as far as you know, you've really done everything by the book, what's that likely to end up? How are you likely to end up? Self-sufficient, self-righteous. In a fair court hearing, God's going to say, this man is innocent. He's done everything perfectly by the book. He's without blame. Are we going to be without blame before God on the basis of our track record? No way. Job will find that out a little later on. And his three friends also believe something like that too. And so there's some things about God that are left out of this equation here. Verse 13, God is unique, and who can make him change? If I went into court and I talked to the judge, I have no idea what he would say to me, because God's unpredictable. You can't. He's not my errand boy. He doesn't hold court just for my benefit. I meet him on his terms. He is unique. Who can make him change? Whatever his soul desires, that he does. God's totally sovereign. He does whatever he wants to do. He's not beholden to anybody. He performs what is appointed for me. My life is in his hands, and I don't know the future, and I don't know why my life has taken this turn, but certainly it was God who brought me this far. Many such things are with him. Therefore, I am terrified at his presence. I'm kind of scared when I look back at this disaster that's happened to me and at the uncertainties in life and the fact that everything can be going really fine for a while and then maybe the whole bottom falls out. And it's kind of scary when you know that that happened because God was involved. We're going to find out, Job's going to find out that God has a very positive reason for allowing this suffering, that it isn't punishment, that it's with the idea of getting Job in the position where he can be blessed much more. But Job doesn't know that yet. We know it, because we've either read ahead or we gleaned it out of the beginning, or we, from the basis of the New Testament, we can look at this book a lot more deeply. God has made my heart weak. The Almighty terrifies me, because I was not cut off from the presence of darkness, and he did not hide deep darkness from my face. Since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know him not see his days? Why is God silent? Why doesn't he tell us what he's doing? Why doesn't he sit down and explain things? Well, not recently, Elaine Stedman said something I liked. She said, God's not in the habit of holding briefings. You're in a situation where a whole bunch of stuff is happening and you don't know how to make decisions, and you think God would call you a special meeting and give you a little synopsis and a little overview and some guidelines for the next 6 months. But it doesn't do that. And that can be a little exasperating, that he sort of doesn't show up and brief you. But then that's probably a good thing too. Now, he now kind of reminisces on some of the bad things that people do, because these friends of his have all brought up human wickedness and human evil over and over and over again. Wicked in the Old Testament, by the way, means unbeliever. That's just a word for unbeliever. We use the word wicked for really bad, nasty criminals and awful, mean people, but the meaning here of wicked is a person who does not believe in God. So Silicon Valley is full of wicked people. It's a little jolting when you think about that, but that's how God looks at it. He looks down on this wicked Bay Area, and there's a little remnant of people here who are not wicked, who are righteous and godly. So now you don't go home and tell your neighbors that they're wicked. You wicked person mowing your lawn on Sunday. Okay, verse 2. Some remove landmarks. There are some bad people in the world who cheat on property boundaries and would move the fence over if they could. There are people who will take some of your sheep out of the flocks when they're grazing in the field. They drive the donkey away from the fatherless. They take the widow's ox as a pledge. They'll cheat widows and orphans when they get a chance. There are people like that in the world. They push the needy off the road. The poor of the land are forced to hide, marginalize the people that are poor. Indeed, wild donkeys in the desert, they go out to their work seeking diligently for food. the wilderness yields food for them and for their children. They gather their fodder in the field and glean in the vineyard of the wicked. So the animals can come in and forage in the bad man's pasture, but the wicked is ruthlessly bad in mistreating widows and orphans and the homeless and the poor, when he could just as well be as generous with them as he is with the wild animals who come into his land. The poor spend the night naked without clothing, and they have no covering in the cold. They're wet with the showers of the mountains, and they huddle around the rock for want of shelter. Some snatch the fatherless from the breast and take a pledge from the poor. Some take mothers away, babies away from their mothers for some reason or another, and try to extract the last penny that the poor man has, to extort. They press out oil within their walls and tread wine presses, yet they suffer thirst. The dying groan in the city, and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not charge them with wrong. The wicked, in other words, the wicked in the world, he says, get away with murder very often, do they not? Or they seem to. They seem to be getting away with murder. What Job has been doing in answering to his friends in the last few chapters here is he has said, no, as I look at the world, I find that the wicked oftentimes are not judged for their sin, and God oftentimes leaves them alone, and we see great evil in the world, and we see evil people prospering, and we do not see this judgment from God that you guys say always inevitably happens. The real world isn't like that. God appears to be treating good people and bad people equally. Silicon Valley is full of rich, prosperous people. Some of them appear to be happy. Some of them are enjoying life up to the hilt, and maybe they really are really bad, and God leaves them alone. And, of course, that would lead you to think that God doesn't judge evil because he's very slow. That's a common argument. Why doesn't God do this and such to fix this and such in an evil world? Okay, now we get this. The dead tremble. Where did I stop? That's not right. I was there. I jumped. I'm on verse. Oh, okay. See, look at this business, how my mind is gone. There are those who rebel against the light. They do not know its ways, nor abide in its paths. That would be, there are people that stumble around in the darkness of the world and have no awareness at all of things that please God. That just live totally ignorant of God and couldn't care less about God or the things that are pleasing God, that would be walk stumbling around against the light, not interested in the light, not following the light. The murderer rises with the morning light and kills the poor and needy. Sometimes you get a murderer will do his murdering right in broad daylight instead of in the dead of night because he's so indifferent to justice. He kills the poor and the needy, and then at night he's like a thief. He does his stealing at night and his murdering in the daytime. That's really bad guy. The eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, nobody will see me. After dark, he sneaks away with his girlfriend and leaves his wife at home, and he thinks he's going to get away with it because it's dark. Well, it's not dark as far as God's concerned. He disguises his face. You know, sometimes you commit adultery, you kind of change your identity around a little bit so nobody will recognize you and get away with it. And if somebody accidentally sees you out with your girlfriend at that neighborhood bar, they'll not recognize that it's that nice Mr. Jones down the street who's got a wife and kids and goes to the 12th Baptist Church and whatever. In the dark, these bad guys break into houses which they marked for themselves. In the daytime, they do not know the light. So these are kind of people that would run down and pick a few houses to burglarize and put an X on their map and then go burglarize them at night, stake them out. The morning is the same to them as the shadow of death. If someone recognizes them, they are in the terrors of the shadow of death. They are afraid. There's a deep fear in people who do evil in the daytime. There's a fear that they might get caught, and they live constantly in that fear. And there is a conscience in them. They should be swift on the face of the waters. Their portion should be cursed in the earth. Bad guys ought to get their due right away. They, you know, in a good world, you'd think that criminals would be apprehended and punished quickly, and adulterers would be caught and corrected quickly, and that's what it ought to be. That's the way it ought to be. So that no one would turn into the way of their vineyards. They ought to be sort of blacklisted, and you wouldn't shop at their store, or you wouldn't buy grapes from their vineyard, because you know that they're bad. But you don't know who's bad very much at the time. As drought and heat consume the snow waters, so should the grave those who have sinned. Sinners really ought to be ephemeral on the scene of life. They really ought to go to the grave in the same way the snow melts suddenly in the winter. God ought to move in and act more justly. He's thinking, this Job thinking out loud here. The womb should forget him. He ought not to be remembered. The worm should feed sweetly on him. Can't wait for him to die so the worms can eat up his corpse. And he should be remembered no more, and wickedness should be broken like a tree. We ought to have movements in the society that deal with evil and make the whole place better for us and safer for us. We all would long for that. Sometimes it doesn't happen. He preys on the barren who do not bear, and he does no good for the widow. He's talking about a really bad guy, kind of person. But God draws the mighty away with his power. He rises up, but no man is sure of life. He gives them security, and they rely on it. Yet his eyes are on their ways. Even in the middle of this, God says that if somebody is rich and famous and powerful, it's God who's put them there. And they are accountable, and they may feel like they've earned it, like Nebuchadnezzar felt he was the one who built Babylon by his own hand. They are exalted for a little while, then they are gone. And he does notice that rich and famous and powerful men are on the stage of life just for a season. And they will perish like with everybody else. They're taken out of the way like all others. They dry out like the heads of grain. Now, it is not so. Who will prove, if this is not so, if I'm not telling you guys the way it really is, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? He's talking to his friends. He's saying, look, is this reasonable? Does this make sense? Is this the way the real world is? Well, his friends are going to have to back off of their rhetoric that God always instantly punishes evil and instantly zaps people. And Job's saying, look, let's take a more balanced view of the way the world really is. All right, Bildad's going to make a speech here, third speech. These three friends are running out of steam quick. They're just the same old arguments over and over again, and they're running out of things to say, and they're getting a little nastier and meaner. Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, and his retreat now, he's going to retreat right back to the position of God being sovereign and God being just. He says, dominion and fear belong to God. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not rise? God has great and mighty armies. He can fix anything he wants. Who can stop him? How then can a man be righteous before God? Now that's a red flag sentence in the book of Job. In fact, it's Job that first asked that question. And Bildad realizes that too. How is it that a man gets truly righteous before God? There's the kind of heart of the whole book of Job. If Job has become self-righteous, say, by trying to follow God and trying to do the right thing, then is that the real, true righteousness that you need? It isn't. It is not quite, no. We have to trade our righteousness for the righteousness of Jesus. We see that clearly, that when we come to know Jesus, we are given his righteousness to live by, and our old, dead self-righteousness is taken away like an old set of clothes. But Job doesn't even see that yet, and we see that because we've read the book of Romans, and we're in the New Testament, and we kind of understand that we cannot on our own merit stand before a holy God. We have to have a mediator and a substitute. So Job, this is a little dim here, but all of these guys sort of are asking themselves, how are we ever going to get really accepted before this kind of an awesome holy God and really know for sure that we're in his family? God hasn't accused Job of anything wrong, and it's God that says that Job is righteous, and Job does therefore have faith, and real faith brings real righteousness, but Job's lifestyle has been that of a man who's proving himself by good deeds. So, self-righteous. Jump to the conclusions that maybe Job's gotten to be a little self-righteous, a little proud of his track record, a little of his standing before God, impeccable. That's I think what we'll see a little bit later on as we go on. Well, this God is really awesome. Where did I stop? The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering. God can look into the grave. He can look into the underworld. He can look into the unseen world. There's no secrets. You know what David says, even if I make my bed in hell or in Sheol, you are there. Even if I were to hide in hell to try to get away from you and make my bed there. Where did I jump to? Oh, 25.5 instead of 26.5. Oh, this is terrible. I'm getting old-timer's disease here. Thank you. That's what the stop button's for. Okay, yes, 25.4. How can a man be righteous before God? That's Bildad. If even the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is a maggot and the son of man a worm? Aren't we all just worms? In the long run, aren't we all just miserable worms destined to die? Well, we think we are, but does God treat us like worms? No. Does God put high value on every one of us, no matter how much we're sinners? Yes. Does he value us greatly? Yes, he does. So God never calls people worms. You might feel like you're a worm. You might think, I'm really no good, that'd be healthy, but God doesn't do that. So, Bildad really is saying here, Job, you really are just like a worm like everybody else, and worms don't have any real rights before God, and worms are nobody. So why don't you just admit you're nobody? Another low blow, another slam. Now, Job's answer. Get this in the right context. How have you helped him who is without power? How? You guys haven't helped me. All three of you have not helped me. How have you saved the arm of him who has no strength? I needed a helping hand, and you, none of you have given me a helping hand or given me any understanding. These guys didn't even bring any salve for his boils. They haven't made his life more comfortable or intervened and put up the fences again and tidied up the house. They're just sitting around complaining. How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? You say that I'm stupid and I'm dumb and I don't have any wisdom. Okay, so I have no wisdom then. I'm sorry, but you still haven't told me anything that I didn't already know. It's kind of sarcastic here. Sarcasm. He says, if I have no wisdom and you haven't taught me anything, then you guys have no wisdom either. You know, we're all in the same boat here together. And your advice isn't better than what I already knew. To whom have you uttered words and whose spirit came from you? I wonder what kind of advice you give to your other friends. Do you take this same approach with everybody you meet? Aren't we supposed to be really good buddies here? So he's kind of saying, hey, you guys, I'm not sure that your track record is going to look all that good on Judgment Day. That's kind of his way of putting his friends back down a little bit. I question your track record. The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before him. Destruction has no covering. That you can't hide from God. God stretches out the north over empty space. There's some marvelous theology in this book and some beautiful poetry about creation. He stretches out the north part of space, the firmament, over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. The earth is a globe, a sphere, hanging on nothing. This is 4,000 B.C. The earth is a rotating sphere hanging in nothing. That's Job, 4,000 years ago. Sort of like modern science thinks they found out in the last 1,000 years or something. No, right here. He binds up the water in his thick clouds. Does God know all about the weather and the weather patterns and storms and hurricanes and the complicated circulation patterns in the oceans and the air? Yes, indeed he does. He binds up the water in thick clouds. The clouds are not broken under it. He covers the face of his throne and spreads his cloud over it. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters. Equator, drew an equator around the sphere over the waters of the earth. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his reproof. It's the ancient worldview is that the whole universe rests on pillars, supported by big, great, giant pillars like columns. The whole universe is kind of in the Hebrew way of looking at things. And when God speaks, the whole pillars of the universe tremble. He stirs up the sea with his power. Great storms and floods and tidal waves at just God's whim. By his understanding, he breaks up the storm. Hurricanes and terrible storms are in the hands of God. That sailors at sea are all too aware of that and cry out and pray like the Jonah's sailor friends did when the storm in the Mediterranean threatened their boat. By his spirit, he adorned the heavens. He made the heavens beautiful with stars and galaxies and beautiful objects that are just like decoration. By his spirit, he adorned the heavens. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. Indeed, there are mere edges. These are mere edges of his ways. That is, we're only getting little glimpses of the greatness of this awesome God. The things in creation just give us a hint of the awesome nature of God and how small a whisper we hear of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? Sometimes God's talking to us just in a little whisper that we barely hear, but he's capable of thundering if he wanted to. This is an incredible God. Now, Job, in Job's talking about the fact that the wicked don't seem to be punished, has made him take a look at the whole world all over again, and he sees that if you look at the rest of the world, it does not appear that God is very much involved in daily life after all, and maybe then perhaps God isn't involved in my current situation. That's kind of what he says. Job continued in his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, treated me really badly in this situation, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you are right, until I die. You friends are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast. Aha. And I will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. My righteousness I will hold fast. Clue? Little clue? Yeah. May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite that he may gain much? If God takes away his life, will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call on God? I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? How's that? You guys, we've all been studying this great universe, and you say that God is great and grand and majestic and just, and we all stand in awe of this awesome God, and you've seen as much as I've seen, and yet your behavior, the way you guys are behaving towards me is total nonsense. All your long speeches haven't helped me one bit. You just made it more painful and more difficult. How's that for three good friends? And we have to assume these guys are believers, so we won't say these are from the out in the camp of the unbelievers. Okay? This is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. There is generational sin. Bad people oftentimes have bad kids, and bad kids have bad children, and people who don't know God tend to just reproduce themselves generation after generation. If his children are multiplied, it's for the sword. That means that you think you're raising your kids right, but they don't know the Lord, so their destiny is not going to be bright unless somebody helps them find the Lord. And those who survive the wicked man will be buried in death, and their widows will not weep. A lot of rich, famous men die, and their widows don't think all that well of them, don't bother to cry over their deceased husbands, because their husbands haven't been all that kind and loving and good after all. Though he heaps up silver, the rich man, like dust, and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it. And that's how Solomon says this in Ecclesiastes, that the rich of this world are busy storing up treasures which are going to be the inheritance of God's people, so they're really working for us. The big buildings they build, the beautiful homes they build, the money there is eventually going to come into the Lord's coffers for the Lord's people. Solomon points that out. So that's God's little reward. One of the rewards for the wicked is they're really earning things for us in the long run. Now, where did I stop? He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes. The rich man will lie down but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes and will be no more. Job's now saying, even though in the world it does not appear that wicked people get their due, in long run, in the end, they really do. That is, God does not overlook them. He will get them. You and I may not see it in daily life, but we can be absolutely sure that God will act justly. And nothing good's going to come in the long run out of the people who now appear so rich, famous, successful. So Job's sort of assuring himself that God is actually in the process of evaluating everybody. And he's just a little slow at it, but it's inevitable. So he builds his house, and God's paying attention to it. And the rich man lies down, and he's going to be no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. An awful lot of rich, famous people have a terrible deathbed experience, yelling and anguish and terror and fear, and it's too late, and they won't repent, and they know perfectly well they've fallen into the hands of an angry God. Very different than one of the saints going home to heaven and with joy and happiness going into the arms of Jesus. It's just a contrast. Terrors overtake the bad guy like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away and he's gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls him. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. So the rich may look like they're important, but they're really not. They're just on the stage of life for a little while, and then they're all going to disappear, and nothing will happen good to their lives. Yeah. Oh, Johnny Cash, yeah. God's going to cut you down. And then the message is a quiet appeal to them. Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you. I think that's neat. 28. Job, chapter 28, Job brings up the subject of mining. And it's really interesting the insights he has about mining for gold and precious metals 4,000 years ago. There's a famous book that you can get in the library by Agricola that was written in 1630 in Latin, and it's called De Re Metallica, and it's a history of mining, how you build mine shafts and how you tunnel and how you haul ore and the work of a miner underground. And in the mining industry today in this country, it's considered to be kind of one of the most ancient books on mining, as if mining was unknown until about 1600 and then somebody kind of discovered it, so it's a modern invention. Nope. Here we have, the next section, we have a picture of mining for ore from 4,000 years ago. Here it is. Surely there is a place for silver, and a place where gold is refined. Ore is hauled out of the ground, melted, and refined. Iron is taken from the earth, and copper is smelted from ore. Even in Old Testament archaeological sites, it's generally believed that iron and copper and bronze were never smelted this far ago. But they are, obviously. Man puts an end to darkness. A man digs tunnels way down into the earth and lights them up. He searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. Mines are very dangerous. They have rock falls and cave-ins and floods. But human beings way back then knew how to tunnel into the earth in search of gold, and tunnel with great energy and great vigor because of the reward of gold. He, the miner, breaks open a shaft away from people, and he has to go way far away up in the mountains, in places forgotten by feet, places way up in the mountains that nobody's ever been before. They hang far away from men. In mining, there's oftentimes in deep shafts, in deep tunnels, in dangerous places where there's a big open pit in front of you, 1,000 feet down, and they swing to and fro, swinging on a cable or a rope or a hoist. As for the earth, from it comes bread. It is the surface of the ground and our farms that give us wheat and grain and bread, but from underneath the earth, it is turned up as by fire. The minerals all in the bottom of the earth are all deposited there by fire as molten ores. And we now understand ore deposits and how they got there through volcanic processes in the heart of the earth. It's 4,000 years ago. Its stones are the source of sapphire. Way down in the ground is where we get those rare and precious sapphires. And way down in the mines, we get gold dust. The mines of South Africa, I think, are about the deepest in the world, and they're a mile or two down. And the ore is very low in gold content, and they haul out tons and tons of ore and put it through a mill in order to get gold dust, small quantity of gold dust you can't even see in the ore. And then that's melted down and into a gold brick that's $100,000 or $1 million per each. Huge. Now, here, this is anticipated by Job. He knows that gold is oftentimes so flaky that you can't see it with the eye. Way down in the mines is the place that no birds go. The falcon's eye has not seen it. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. If you ever have a chance to go in an old mine, they're kind of spooky and scary and interesting, and it's just like going into a whole other world, so different from life on the surface. The miner puts his hand to the flint. He overturns the mountains at the roots, way down deep under the roots of the mountains. He cuts out channels in the rock, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams from trickling. What is hidden, he brings forth to light. One of the great dangers in underground mining is water coming in great floods and flooding out the mine. And one of the things miners have to do is take care of the water and pipe it out and pump it out. And the deeper mines of the earth have got enormous pumps that do nothing but lift out water. And the miner is searching for the elusive sapphires and the elusive gold, and it's so beautifully captured here in this poetry. Now, it's very difficult, but men are highly motivated to go find gold. Now, let's how he applies that. But where can wisdom be found? If there's anything we really need, it's not gold. It's wisdom. Where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. Everywhere you can look through life, and you can find people that are educated and well-read and full of knowledge, but where do you go to find a wise man or a wise woman? Where? Very rare. Particularly information age, no end of information. You can get on Google and find all sorts of stuff, data. But how are you going to act wisely in life? Who knows? The important question? Big deal. If Job had wisdom at this point in his life and he really understood what God was doing, he had the big picture, he'd feel very differently about his situation. Where is wisdom? If you can't find wisdom on earth, where is wisdom? God has wisdom. God, in Proverbs, we find that that through wisdom, God created the universe. And in God creates everything through wisdom, that there's the wisdom of God is in everything that he has made. It's just inherent in the whole universe. And God himself is the only source of wisdom. And so if we want wisdom, we're going to only find it in God. Where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, the ocean says, I don't. It's not in me. The sea says, it's not with me. It cannot be purchased for gold, can't go buy wisdom, nor can silver be weighed for its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, southern Arabia, rich country. in precious onyx or sapphire. The wealth of the world will not get you wisdom, buy it for you. Neither gold nor crystal, or pearls or jewels, can equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewelry of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or quartz. The price of wisdom is higher than rubies. The topaz stone of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. So this is great, one of the great dilemmas in life. There's no way you can get the wisdom you need by any spending any amount of money. How many people spend money for psychotherapy or special health foods or all kinds of medical treatments and wonderful stuff, and because you really want to find the health and happiness and wisdom and the secret of life, and it eludes us. And how fortunate we are that we have in our lives Christ, the wisdom of God. 1 Corinthians goes into this at great length about how we are so privileged to have, through Jesus, the access to the very wisdom of God, and it's our legacy. But Job doesn't see that yet. Where does this wisdom come from, and where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living. Well, that's not quite true, because it's not hidden from our eyes, and it won't be hidden from Job's eyes, but right there, this is what he's thinking right now. It's concealed from the birds of the air. Death and destruction say, we've heard a report about it with our ears. We've heard there is such a thing as wisdom, but we don't know anything about it. God understands its way, and he knows its place. He looks to the ends of the earth, and he sees under the whole heavens to establish a weight for the wind. Here's how God has used wisdom in creating. He established a weight for the wind. He decided how much air should weigh, because that would affect storms and winds, how heavy air should be. Do you ever think about that? That we're under a weight of air right now, and if the air was thicker, we'd have more violent storms. Well, God used wisdom in designing the atmosphere. And he also used wisdom when he measured out the waters of the oceans and set the boundaries for the oceans and the lakes and the streams. He made a law for the rain and the circulation of the atmosphere, a path for the thunderbolt. Then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it indeed. He searched it out, and to no man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So God used wisdom and didn't make it generally known to the world. But he only makes it known to his people, So this is really very eloquent, wonderful pictures of creation. And as I mentioned in Proverbs, wisdom is God's partner in the creation of the universe. And wisdom, I think, you can equate to be the second person of the Trinity. All right? Job continues. We've got to stop in a minute. Push the stop button when we're done, and I'll shut up. Job further continued his discourse and said, oh, that I were as in months past. Now he's getting a little nostalgic and looking back to the good old days. As in the days when God watched over me. Doesn't feel God's watching him over him right now, but of course God is. But he looks back to the prosperity. When his lamp, God's lamp, was shone upon my head, when God favored me, when by his light I walked through the darkness, when I felt close to God, when I felt him with me before this tragedy came. Just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, God favored me and blessed me and guided me and gave me good direction, and I missed those days. When the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were yet around. So now he's really feeling the sadness of the death of 10 of his children all in one day, and how he misses them and loved them and would love to be back with them. When my steps were bathed with cream, and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me, when I was rich and I could have anything I wanted to eat, and I lived very, very comfortably with a big high-definition TV and four sports cars and big swimming pool, and I had just an absolutely wonderful, comfortable home, and God gave it all to me. And what great days those were. And apparently they're gone forever. Well, not really, but when I went out to the gate of the city, when I went downtown, when I went over to the mall, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid. They were scared of that Job. He's such an awesome man. And the aged rose and stood and honored him. Job's friends have Job's friends have pointed out how he's the laughingstock of the neighborhood now, and how all the little children and all of his neighbors look down on him and consider him that he's a loser. And he says, it didn't used to be like that. I was honored and respected in town. And even the older people in town would stand up when I came in. So I really missed that place of honor that I had. Is he going to get it back? Yeah, he'll get it back, but he doesn't see that yet. The princes refrained from talking. Even high officials wouldn't gossip about me. The princes refrained from talking and put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, it blessed me. When the eye saw, it approved me. Because I delivered the poor who cried out. His friends have said that he never paid any attention to the poor, and he refutes that. He says, yes, I was generous and philanthropic, and I did care for the poor. And when I saw somebody in need, I took care of their need. And I helped the fatherless, and I helped the people who had no helper. And that refutes the arguments of his friends who said, you're a liar and a cheat, and you've been dishonest. The slander of his friends. What we're probably going to find in a minute is Job's going to get around to telling his friends that false witness is a really bad deal, and their false witness is going to come into bring them into account with God, and that's a big serious sin. So they're in trouble because they've slandered and lied about him, and he warns them, in fact. Don't run around slandering people and bearing false witness against them. Okay, let's see now. Where did I stop? 13. The blessing of a perishing man came upon me. He helped the people who were sick and dying. I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. Met an old widow in town, and she was destitute, so he gave her some money and helped her out and restored her well-being and her property, because in that world, the death of a husband meant you'd lost your income and sustenance. Not usually. Oftentimes not. You see, it's a matter of his heart more than anything else. We're kind of looking at his mind. Job actually believes that he is a righteous man through and through, and that his life will pass inspection at the judgment day, and that he'll emerge without flaw on the other side. We're going to find out that that changes a little bit later. And this is a moral, upright, God-fearing man. So this, you know, Job applies to all of us. He knows that God has allowed this, but he's certainly very frustrated that God hasn't explained it yet. And he's been crying out in pain for God to please explain this. And God, the silence of God is really hard for him. The fact that God won't answer him bothers him a lot. The silence of God. No, he doesn't have a clue that the devil's in on this. He hasn't made that connection yet, and he will. So he's not going to. Well, he wouldn't deny that he was a sinner, but he would say I've done everything by the book as best I know how. As far as I know, I've dealt with all the sin in my life, and I've got a good track record of being moral. But let's look a little bit here. Look at verse 14. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth. Anything about that? I. Look what I did for God. Look what I did for God. Look at my record. Look at all the things I've done for God. Does that count with God? Doesn't count with God. But you could easily think that it did, couldn't you? Well, he thinks it's true, but only the things that God does through us, for which we can't get credit, only those things are of really lasting value. Not our best efforts for God. He has a pride problem, and we'll see that in a little bit. And so do his friends. They've got a big pride problem. Yes, he's justifying himself. Yeah. He is justifying himself. That's exactly right. And we would do that oftentimes real easy. John. Yeah. Christ on the cross will will vindicate those who put their faith in God. And Abraham put his faith in God repeatedly. He trusted God again and again and again and again, but he had to trust God quite a few times before you come to the place where God said, your faith is imputed to his righteousness is imputed to you because of your faith. Didn't happen at the first time he obeyed God. A little later on, he grew and obeyed and grew and obeyed until there was a point of clarity. Yeah. We're talking about motive. Time's just about, can we finish the chapter real quick? 18. I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. I have lived a good life. I've lived a life of faith. Men listened to me and waited, and kept silent for my counsel. I've given all kinds of people good advice my whole long life. After my words, they did not speak again. They couldn't answer back to my advice. My speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain. They opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. People came to me for advice and considered me a reputable source of wisdom for living their lives. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it. I could tease them and they wouldn't take me seriously, which is good. The light of my countenance did not cast down. I chose the way for them and sat as chief. I gave people advice on how to live their lives. I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. I'm a senior statesman around here, and I'm highly regarded. And I just look at all the list of people that I've helped and blessed and guided. Well, it's really true that he probably has done these things, but who gets the credit for it? Well, he's in trouble if he thinks he did it on his own. Then he's basically, if he thinks he's a good person. Okay? Is that sort of clear so far? Well, next week we got more. We're not far from the end of all these speeches. Rick, how about if you would like to stand up and pray real loud for us and then...